we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense, in which we look at these different stories that get told following successful or adverse events, normally adverse events. And those first stories are the ones that come out straight away. They are limited in their narrative. They're often blameworthy. They've got counterfactuals. They're very simple. They're very linear. And they're the ones that we hear first off. And they're the ones that frame how we think going forward. But there's always another story, that deeper second story. And invite the guests on to talk about these second stories and how it makes sense for people to do what they did. And today's session, I've got Becky Ray, who's a good friend of mine, been working together for a number of years, on and off, and we share a passion about improving people and making them better. So, Becky, tell people about who you are, what do you do, how did you get to where you are, and where people can find you online and in person.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. We share a passion from this, but we come at it from very different angles, which I love. So my background, so I started as an engineer. I spent 10 years driving a van, wearing overalls, using my hands. So I'm really operationally focused because I've been there and got my hands dirty myself. I then moved into the health and safety leadership space, working in high risk, safety critical environments like rail, infrastructure, military aviation, manufacturing. And so I've got loads and loads of stories from kind of those two decades worth of kind of operational experience. I now run my own business called Culture Kick. So I partner with typically operational leaders and empower them to create high performing cultures where essentially people can just be better people. Because I believe if you're a better person with an open mindset and you care about this kind of stuff, you care about context and you go out and find it, you can then become a better leader. And only then can you build better workplace culture. So like you said, I'm all about helping people to be better. And we think we can all do a little bit of that.
Excellent. And where would people find you online? What's the website? What's a good email address for you?
Website is www.culturekick.co.uk. And you can also find me on LinkedIn under Becky Ray and Culture Kick.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for that. And what's really interesting is one of those sort of simple narratives when we have a bad outcome, there's this bit that says, pay more attention, be more careful, be better. But actually, I think you're doing be better from a position of genuine development, as opposed to, you know what, just get better at what you do. So tell us your first story about an event and yeah, go for it.
Yeah, and again, I wrapped my brains about finding a real juicy one to bring to the table, because as you can imagine, I've got loads. But I thought of this one, and this one's probably about 15 years ago. This happened at a company I was supporting, and I've supported loads and loads of companies, lots of different industries. But essentially, there was a technician, a qualified, trained, experienced technician, was working on a HGV, a heavy goods vehicle trailer, to change a tyre, and they worked underneath an unsupported load, and they unfortunately crushed their skull and their shoulder. So quite a nasty accident. Luckily, they have walked away and survived, but life sort of changing, potentially fatal injuries that this poor chap was exposed to. He failed to use the correct equipment, he failed to use safety equipment, and he failed to follow the safe working procedure for this particular task, and then ended up with a squished head and a squished shoulder.
And you know, I can imagine straight away those counterfactuals that you just used, failed to, should have, that were there. And you know, people don't go to work to, we say this, people don't go to work to do a bad job, and that's sort of given as a truism. But there is a self-protection gene that sits inside us to sit there and go, you know what, if we knew with 100% certainty that that adverse event was going to occur, well, we wouldn't do it. So what's the local rationality? How did it make sense for that worker to be in that situation and end up with the outcome he did?
Yeah, and as and like you said, like sometimes you only get that little bit that I just kind of gave away. And typically, if you work in an organization and an accident or incident just happened, that's the only headline that comes your way. Like person squashed, fractured skull, and they worked under a vehicle that was unsupported. And then people naturally jump to all kinds of assumptions about what this person did. But you're right, nobody gets up in the morning and goes, I know what I'll do today. I will squash my own skull underneath a heavy goods vehicle, because nobody would do that. And this poor chap, that was never his intention. So there is loads and loads of context to this story. So let me play it out for you. So this chap was, he was trained, he was qualified, he was experienced, he knew what he was doing. His job was a technician. He typically would change the tires on big trucks, big lorries. He had a van that he drove around. He had all the kit he needed to do that. This particular day, it was a Saturday night job, so it was an out of hours job. He actually wasn't supposed to be working that weekend. The person that was supposed to be working was taken ill, so he got a phone call late on a Saturday night. It was dark outside, he was at home enjoying his weekend off with his family, and a branch manager rang him and went, oh, can you please cover it because such and such is busy and such is busy, so can you do it? So straight away, it's an out of the normal kind of situation. He's having to like put his coat on, go outside when it's cold and dark, and leave his family and his home behind. Equally, on the Friday before, he'd been asked by the branch manager to take out all of his jacks, all of his axle stands, all of his props, and all of his kind of safety critical equipment, and leave it at the workshop, because as you can imagine, stuff, equipment like that needs to be checked by a competent person at regular intervals and kind of ticked off from a compliance point of view. So he'd left all of his kit at the depot on the Friday, but he thought he wasn't going to need it because he had a week off.
So interestingly, there's a couple of bits straight away for my assumptions was that this was at a depot. It was like, when you told that first story, my first thought was, oh, this is at a standard sort of facility. And then when you talked about taking the tools and things out, my immediate thought there was risk of theft, of actually, van break-ins and things being stolen. So I've already made two assumptions just on that little piece of the story. So carry on, tell us a little bit more.
So the branch manager jumps, rings this guy, and again, he's putting pressure on, saying, can you do this job? We need to do it quickly. The other bit of context about the particular job and the particular client was it was a new client, and the commercial team, like the salespeople, had said, oh, we'll do this as a favor to you. And then there's the potential that if we do this job and we do it well, then it could turn into a bigger kind of commercial contract. So again, there's that pressure of, oh, can you just go and do it? Just do it quick. It's a relatively simple job to take a wheel off, strip the tire off, bang a new one on, stick it on. These guys can do it in like minutes because it's their bread and butter. So there was the assumption that, oh, we'll just go and we'll do it because they've done jobs like that before. They've done them out of hours. They've done them for new clients in new locations. So although that was novel, it's actually kind of the norm. So he explains to the branch manager, I haven't got all my gear because I got told to drop it off by Bob. And he's like, oh, well, what have you got? So we found a jack in his own garage and he went, this will do. And again, he's not being reckless. He had a go-getting attitude, because the business was expressing that this was important, not just a normal job, this was potentially a new commercial contract.
Yeah.
Obviously, this technician wants to do a good job. So he's like, right, I've got enough for what I need. The tire was a bog standard size. He had it in stock. So we drove to the location. The driver is like, I've got to go. I've got to get this. I've got to get that. So there's pressure on the site from the driver, because obviously when a vehicle breaks down in any way, it's just a delay and it's a temporary pull.
It's a jigsaw puzzle as well, because that truck will be in a schedule somewhere and there's a knock-on effect in terms of that driver's worker hours. And they're sort of part in the bigger puzzle that's there. So interesting. Yeah. Carry on.
We don't know how long they've been waiting. We don't know how long it had taken to ring people around. So again, there's pressure on time from all parties here. And the guy who's just like left his home with his family in the warm, probably watching a movie or football, having a nice time, is like, I'm just going to nip out, do it and get back. So there is quite a drive on time. So he gets there, he has a look at the trailer, he's got the right tyre, he checks it. It's, again, relatively simple job. You lift up a trailer with a hydraulic jack, and the two kind of safety rules that are standard on any vehicle are chocks, which are two things you put around the wheel that's on the floor to stop the vehicle moving.
Yep.
Relatively simple piece of kit, takes you seconds to get involved. And then axle stands. So if you lift up a vehicle with a hydraulic jack, there's always a chance that the jack could fail. Mm-hmm. So then you put a physical kind of axle stand in place, all blocks of woods.
Just something to limit where it falls down. If it fails, it's going to hit something solid and that's where we should be. That's cool, yeah.
And it's fail-safe. So that was kind of we called them cardinal rules. Mm-hmm. Like these are the two things you do on any vehicle, regardless of size or weight. But this guy didn't have chocks and he didn't have axle stands and he didn't have wood or anything. He just had this one jack, because remember, all his gear was at the workshop. But these rules and the fact that they were enforced as cardinal rules was quite a recent thing. Mm-hmm. And this guy's been doing this job 15, 20 years without that kit, and nothing's ever gone wrong.
Yeah.
And so he thinks, I can just do this job and it's not going to fail because it's never failed before. Now, again, there's a bit more context. So typically a trailer, and I've got 10 years as a mechanic, so I kind of get this, but I want to explain it in really simple terms. It's just a rigid bit of metal that you can lift up.
Is this like a sort of a standard articulated sort of 40-foot trailer, or is it something else?
Yeah, so we thought it was just a standard trailer, but the extra context in this, because remember, it's a new client, it was a self-leveling trailer.
Okay.
So it doesn't operate in the same way as a rigid piece of metal that you're lifting up.
Mm-hmm.
So we used the jack, he lifted up the vehicle, he took the wheel off, changed the tire, and was in the process of putting the wheel back on. And sometimes it takes a bit of jiggery pokery to get it back on. So at this point, his body was underneath the trailer and it had been held by the jack perfectly fine all this time. Now the jack didn't fail, which lots of people might have assumed. The jack didn't fail. The jack was adequate for the job. But the trailer was a unique trailer and the guy wasn't aware that it was a different kind of trailer. And it had a more comprehensive system of hydraulics in, and it had like a self-leveling thing. So even though we lifted up one side, over time, it was kind of trying to level itself out. So it slowly, as he was underneath, it slowly moved down on him. And we're talking tons and tons of weight. And then because he was in an awkward position, it crushed his skull and his shoulder, but he managed to get out.
So it wasn't a catastrophic failure. It was a slow change. Okay.
It was slow, kind of rigid down to get him. And so even if he did have his axle stands, because it was a novel piece of kit, the normal standard, just a jack and an axle stand, wouldn't have done it. They needed to assess how it worked. And sometimes you can shut off the self-leveling stuff, but you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
He didn't know that was a thing. So in the fact that he didn't follow the safe working procedure, it's because there wasn't one.
And actually, if he did, it wouldn't have made any difference for his standard safe working practices for that situation.
So we get loads and loads of context around that. And again, this guy didn't go out and go, I'm going to be reckless, I'm going to do this job. Like, he was doing the best he could. He had a go-getter attitude. But there was the context that his kit was somewhere else. But even if he had his kit, it wouldn't have worked.
In the way he'd expected.
And they didn't have a written down safe working procedure for him to follow, because nobody had written it yet in the context of this company, because it was a brand new client with a unique kind of vehicle.
Wow. And so that's a really interesting piece, that the assumption is that the paperwork is going to keep you safe, or the process is going to keep you safe. And that then follows on, that the process, the procedure, whatever that work is, imagined work as prescribed, actually matches the environment that we're in to start with. And I think it's a really interesting piece where we've got external contractors, we've got a new system that the sales manager probably is unaware of that variety. Yeah. You know, there's me as a pretty simple guy. It's a truck, it's a flatbed, it's a trailer, off you go. And it's whether or not even the driver of that trailer, that tractor trailer unit, knew the implications of doing a wheel change. Because if that driver has never been in that situation where he's had to change it on the roadside or whatever, but actually, you know, all of the changes have happened in depot, so actually it's not an issue, or he never actually encounters it, he wouldn't be in a position to guide the changing person to say, actually, this is a bit different, and you might not be able to do that. So it's a really interesting piece there. I'm guessing that the driver of that tractor unit was the guy that basically then phoned the ambulance, and they got the emergency services in sorted. Was it a mature organization? Was the learning, or was it a case of be more careful? And what was the learning that came out of it?
Yeah, so I'd say they weren't as mature as they could be. And I'd say, again, because that was a good 10, 15 years ago, I wasn't as mature as I was in my opinion of that. And now, but when you get all the context, because you want to get so much context, but you're like, that makes sense.
So were you the sort of the health and safety officer for the company then?
Yeah.
What was your first thought when you got that call? So this is a really cool bit of actually going winding back and say, and recognizing that this is 15 years ago. What was your first thought when you got that call to say, hey?
You definitely think about the person first. Like, most people have got innate empathy for somebody's been hurt, like to the skull, and it's a big deal, isn't it?
When
you
squash
your head. But then there is the whole, because as health and safety professionals, we get told our job is to protect the company, not the people.
In a
And so there was a big rush of senior leaders and the other health and safety people to because naturally the health and safety executive were going to get involved, an accident of that level, they want to ask questions. And so we had to run around and go, right, we need to know the context of this. And really, unfortunately, I want to say that the company learned and were open and empathetic, but there is the whole, how do we cover ourselves for this? Which is really sad. But there's so much learning to be had here. And also, this probably happened a number of times without the bad outcome. And it probably would have gone amiss. And then we lost the opportunity to learn because of it. But there's so many juicy bits of learning from it. And so many points where you could say, well, he shouldn't have done that. And he shouldn't have done that. And he should have stopped. But again, most workers get up in the morning to go, I'm going to do a great job for my company and get stuff done.
Yeah.
And that potentially would have won new business and new contracts and got salespeople extra commission in their pockets and stuff, because workers are go-getters if they get stuff done. But
it's really interesting. So the bit about paperwork is an interesting one. I've been to a couple of places recently. One where it's basically something goes wrong and it's like, oh no, we're going to go and backfill all the paperwork to make sure that, it's all compliant for when, the investigation team come in and go, right, give us everything. And you sit there going, but that's, does it contribute to the safety of the event, or is it about the compliance piece? And then something today, where I was working with an organization and they were listing all of their crew competencies of the operating crew. And actually, this was an engineering failure point that was basically down to an O-ring and not having thread lock in place. And you sit there and go, why are you collecting that data? Because it doesn't contribute to the safety of what's going on. Now, you could sit there and go, the purpose of the investigation is about the wider learning. So we sit there and go, right, are we operating with people who aren't current, who aren't competent? And so that's one piece. But at the same time, if the investigation team are spending a disproportionate amount of time checking on the administrative side as opposed to the operational side, where's the learning? Where are the learning opportunities being missed because people are into that? Now, I'm not a safety person. I'm an operational person. So I don't, I know that there's all of this legislation and the frameworks that have to be in place to make sure that things are compliant. But I'm also the operational side to sit there and go, you know what? Paperwork doesn't make safety. And there was a quote that I quoted from a Danish Maritime Accident Investigation Board piece. And it was just like, there should be a recognition that this bureaucracy does not create safety in of itself. It manages the paperwork risk, but it doesn't create safety. And for that to happen, we've got to have the competencies, and we've got to understand the variance of activity that's out there. And that goes to the point where, both you and I working in organizations to say, you've got to create that culture to find that the work is the gaps between work is imagined, work is done, and work is disclosed, because that's the risk that exists for an organization. You can't fix a secret.
No, and my point about the whole there wasn't a written down safe procedure for this is that this guy couldn't follow something that didn't exist. And I'm not saying a piece of paper would have fixed it, but there wasn't even that process of going, right, if we're going to do this task on this particular vehicle, it's different to the standard one. So we need something a bit novel. We set him up to fail essentially by sending him to a job that didn't compute in the same way as most other trailers did.
And I'm
So the
sure
paperwork
this, yeah.
him, but the paperwork definitely would have kept the health and safety executive happier, because then they could blame the paperwork. They would blame the culture around the adherence to the paperwork. But obviously they got very excited that we didn't have any paperwork, which proved that we'd not assessed the risk in really simple terms. There was a risk to this person's health, and we didn't see it, identify it, and do anything about it. We just sent them out and hope for the best, which is,
And I
which
think
is not great.
no,
It
it's
happens every
not.
day.
And it ties into something else that both you and I talk about, is this bit that, we need to have this ability to speak up and challenge. And I'm sure there are people who will be listening to this going, what we need is a stop work authority. They should be empowered to stop that job. And you sit there and go, actually, what social conditions, what social construct allows that to happen? And if you go back 15 years, psychological safety was just being talked about at, but at your sort of level as a sort of wheel repair company, tire repair company, it won't have been down there. So it's all very well to say they should stop that job, they should just speak up and say something, but you've just described all of that power, literally, the power dynamics that exist that sit there and say, you know what, a manager says this, and you've got somebody who wants to get the job done, and they've got that. It is not easy to sit there and go, I'm not doing this because we don't have the paperwork. Oh, really? Just get on and do that.
And it's because I, as an engineer myself, there's loads of times where I did something that I didn't know how to do, or there was no paperwork to do, because you can't write paperwork for every scenario when you're fixing something. Like I used to fix like 100 different trucks. Like I'd go to something I'd never seen, and you have to just give it a go, but you learn as you go. And loads of people have got that go-getting attitude, which is great. But without the speak-up culture, you can't then learn from that. Like, there's gold dust in everything I learned from learning from failure in my own, like, experience that I didn't have the opportunity to learn from and share wider across the company because there was no kind of appetite for that.
And it's also, if the organisation doesn't have a decent learning process about telling stories, about understanding the conditions, rather than just, what's the root cause of this? Well, they didn't pay attention, that's why. Well, actually, we don't have root causes in these sort of situations. It's understanding all of the pieces together. And it's like the conversation today I had with a head of safety was, you know, they're sitting in the safety space, but they're only managing one part of what creates safety in an organization. And that could be infrastructure. It could be engineering. It could be the HR or the administrative functions that are going on that are driving things. And, you know, this organization takes reputation really seriously, public reputation. And that shapes their culture. We cannot fail. We cannot be seen to fail because we have a reputational risk that we're trying to manage. So there's many little things that dig into this. The sort of the closing piece of the sort of the main chunk of the study, I'm sure we'll disappear down some rabbit holes, is something, either a book or an article or a video, that's really sort of triggered your thought processes about the way you think about creating better leaders, better cultures. What, you know, when we were discussing beforehand, it's like, I don't know. But there must have been something that you sit there and go, you know what? What do you recommend to people to go and read, watch, or consume?
I mean, there's loads. There's loads of stuff. So there's loads of books.
You've got one. Pick one.
All right. So the one I'm going to, and I won't know his name, but I know you will. Derek, I want to say Haggerty.
All right. Haggerty. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So that white paper that we've both used and we've pulled it apart and used it as an exercise, because it's a great example of the first story, essentially, one that's got very, very limited context, and then the second story that's got sort of witness statements from people involved and loads more context. And we've used it as an exercise. Obviously, you can read the white paper as is, but we've turned it into an exercise and used it with leaders.
Yeah.
If you get people to just listen to the first bit, they naturally jump to loads of assumptions and judgments. But then when you give people all of the context, similar to how we've discussed this incident, you want people to go, ah, that makes sense now. And if you don't get to the point where you're like, ah, that makes sense, you haven't got enough context and you need to keep looking, keep asking questions and keep kind of being open to, it must have made sense for this person to do this thing, because nobody wants to crush their own skull, do they?
Absolutely. So the paper is from Derek Haggerty, and it's called Accident Report Interpretation. And I'll put it into the show notes. And the exercise, so that the paper takes a single narrative and it takes a multi-person narrative. And what they asked the respondents when they were doing this research was, look at this single narrative. What do you think? And it was very blameworthy, lots of counterfactuals, because people naturally fill those gaps in themselves. If we don't have it, we use our experience and we fill those gaps. Now, the second version of that, what goes further than what we've just done here, is it would tell a multi-narrative, a multi-actor narrative or timeline. So there are about six or seven people involved in this event, which was a dropped object from height. And then you start to hear all of their different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And once you tell that multi-actor narrative, people go, oh. And what was really interesting when Becky and I run these exercises is the language that's being used. Mm-hmm. So in that first narrative, there's loads of counterfactuals. People do that judging. Should have, could have, would have, failed to. It was obvious. And then the sorts of stories that are told in the other story, the other version, are very much light bulby type moments.
Oh, I get it now.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I used as part of my master's research, was the fact that if you tell a context-rich story, you tell a simple story and you ask people, would you be willing to share that to the community, the diving community, which is where my research was? And they're like, nope, not really. And so right now, let's tell the really context-rich story, which is about three times as long. So the first story was about 350 words. The other one was about 1,000 words. And it's like, would you be willing to share that story? It's like, yeah, because people can now understand how it made sense for me to do that. So understanding those stories. Now, an interesting byproduct was lots of people wouldn't read the long story. They'd stop at about 300 words because you're going, oh, I'm bored. Move on.
Quick and get to the point, because I've got to get to my next thing. I need to just give it to me small, but you lose the ability to be empathetic and compassionate. And that's what we want leaders to be. But they can only have that if you give them enough so they go, oh, right, I get it now.
Absolutely. And so last week,
on this, go, quick, deal with it. Take time, because learning takes time to process it and get it all in.
You've got to be curious.
You say, it's like a jigsaw, and you need all of it to come together to go, right, now.
Yeah.
That's what we learn from.
And that ability to abstract from, say, one story to another triggered something with me last week where, you know, we were operating in the sort of safety and operational space. And I was just thinking, when you're in businesses, executives want bullet points. They don't want the context-rich story. And so you end up in a situation where the frontline operators will write an explanation about what's happened. And it will go to the supervisor, then it'll go to the middle management. And each time it's being simplified, it's being shrunk down. And then it basically gets presented to the top team and go, there we go, he screwed up because of this. Yeah. It's like, well, why didn't he do what he was supposed to do? It's like,
it's like Chinese whispers. It gets misinterpreted and simplified and shortened to the point of guy under a truck, didn't use an axle sand, squashed his head.
Yeah, absolutely. And you sit there going, and so the bit then that I sort of took away from this discussion piece about organizations is part of that is because those in the senior leadership positions are being made accountable for what's going on down there. They're being held responsible for a failure. And so there's the bit that says, actually, I trust my team. If they've given me a simple answer, that is good enough. And I trust them to get on and do that. And I trust them to have provided some learning hypotheses, you know, some recommendations that say, you know what, we'll try this. It might work, probably would work because we've gone through it, but there's no guarantee that it will create final change. You know, it will always stop that event. It's like, maybe not. So
if we had that magic wand to stop all similar events, we would have all done it by now, wouldn't we? But
well, so there's a really powerful bias there that we just look at that and go, oh, it wouldn't happen to me. Because what they're different. I'm not stupid like they are. And it requires that curiosity, that empathy to say, what are the conditions that led to that? Not the, what's the behavior? What's the choice that they made to be unsafe? It's like, well, nobody chooses to be unsafe, or very few people choose to be unsafe. Yeah. That definition of unsafe is when we've had the adverse event and somebody's been hurt or material's been damaged or killed, and you sit there and go, yep, that was unsafe. You go, what about beforehand?
Yeah.
So that's really good. So Becky, really cool to speak to you. Anything else that you would add to the community here?
No, I would just say, like, so my favourite saying is be curious, but curiosity on its own potentially is just nosy. So you need to be curious and non-judgmental. Those two have to be coupled together, and you need to continue to be curious until you go, that makes sense now. And until you reach that point, you have not finished. So keep going. It will take longer. It will take more time and attention, but it's worth it in the end to get that real learning that you can actually do something with and improve stuff.
Brilliant. And that echoes with a book that I was listening to while driving today, Humble Inquiry by Edgar Schein. And it's all about that piece, that curiosity and the questioning, the skill in crafting the questions that are there because you don't know the answer, as opposed to sort of trip me up type open leading questions that go, I want you to justify your position. So, Becky, thank you very much for your time.
You're
great
welcome.
To see you again, and we'll catch up in person soon.